right, folks, welcome to Green Pill, where we focus on making health simple for you, but more importantly, for your family, loved ones, and community. Today's guest is Chris Voss. Chris is the former lead hostage negotiator for the FBI, having spent 24 years at the Bureau, leading and building a team of 90 agents, both nationally and worldwide, dealing with crises, kidnappings, and the like. Following the FBI, Chris went to study and then teach at Harvard, teach at Georgetown, and most recently at the University of Southern California, USC. Chris is the owner of the Black Swan Group, which leads negotiation trainings for individuals and companies. And recently, he's been featured on Andrew Huberman's podcast, Lex Fridman, and others. Today, we're going to hear a different side of Chris. He'll tell his personal health journey, from how his mom and dad lived and passed away, how that influenced his decisions, and how he negotiates himself into doing things which are tough in the short term, but benefit himself and his health in the long term. In today's episode, you'll learn how to help a loved one get healthier, how to help someone get out of their own way, how to communicate about tough subjects like you need to change or you're going to get really sick, or you know, you might benefit from going to therapy, how not to talk about these subjects, his insights from Brené Brown on shame and why he's such a big fan, how to talk about shame with loved ones, how to confront it, and how it actually, you know, this feeling controls our lives. You'll also learn how to, again, talk yourself into doing something that's painful in the short term, but really, you know, will benefit you in the medium to long term, like cold plunges, exercise, changing your diet, etc. Before we start, I'd like to tell a quick anecdote about how Chris Voss's techniques, as applied by me, actually kept me out of jail, if you can believe it or not, for at least half a year or a year. So I want to preface that by saying this is a much different time in my life. I was much younger, and I think it's important that we be publicly vulnerable and or at least vulnerable with our close friends, family, and loved ones. It's critical for emotional health to be open about your past and to not hide things in shame, as you'll hear in the upcoming podcast. Here we go. So a number of years back, I was at a concert with a friend and I was dancing with a couple girls. We were having a good time. They said, can you buy us a drink? Well, I go to buy them a drink at the counter. I come back and there's a bunch of cops surrounding us. Before I know it, I'm in handcuffs and I'm saying, well, you know, those girls are underage. That's what I'm hearing from the cops. I say, sir, thank you. I understand. You know, I totally understand why you're here. I didn't know that. You know, he said, well, one of them is my good friend's daughter. I said, wow, I can see, you know, imagine how rough this is for you, seeing some random guy buying them drinks. Well, next thing I know, I'm in the lockup or the jail, as it were, of the concert. Something clicked in my head as soon as the cops came over, and I wasn't sober, I should say. And I thought to myself, I need to get out of this situation. I started trying to empathize with the cops, trying to make them see me as someone who didn't mean this, was in an accidental situation, respected their authority, and had nothing but, you know, remorse for what I had done. So I used a few techniques to do so. I asked them about their day. I echoed what they were saying about just being a busy night, etc. So we made small talk. We made a bunch of jokes somehow. And the guy next to me was whispering to me, hey man, don't talk to them. They're not on your side. And I publicly out loud in the lockup said, no, they're just doing their job. They're nice guys. They're just trying to protect us. So I did a lot of connecting with them, validating with them, making sure that I tried to win them over using my charisma. It was a really, really powerful moment for me because what happened next was pretty nuts. At one point, they said to me, listen, who are you here with? I told them my friend's name. They said, give me your phone. They called my friends. My friends came. They said, listen, have a good night. He shook my hand and I walked out of there, not facing a felony, not facing a misdemeanor for 6 months, but walking out. I'm getting chills talking about it because Chris's techniques, which I'd been studying that year and earlier, really helped me connect with those folks, get on their level, and get what I needed to get done. So in this upcoming podcast, you're going to hear a lot of those techniques in action as it relates to health. And I look forward to your feedback and to doing more of these. First episode, Chris Voss, here we go. Chris, thank you so much for coming on. I want to say that you helped me a lot with your book, and I really studied all of your podcasts, talks, etc. when the book came out. Welcome to Green Pill.
Thank you, man. I'm happy to be on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. Chris, I looked up in Webster today how health is defined, and it looks like it's the condition of being sound in body, mind, and spirit. Do you differ from that at all?
No, I like that. I think that's a great combination. And those three things, depending upon the terminology, are really interwoven in the conversations among scientists or, you know, just human beings, philosophers. You know, the spirit, some people refer to it as consciousness. Some other people refer to it as a mind. But it very much seems to be three components there.
So body, mind, it could be consciousness, and spirit, or
and spirit,
maybe
yeah.
what stays with you after you leave, or maybe what comes back, you know, according to some people.
Yeah, who knows, right?
We could probably spend the whole hour on that, and maybe we will, so I'm an open book. Yeah, how do you think about spirit, you know, really, for you?
Yeah, you know, while I'm religious and spiritual simultaneously, and I don't think to be spiritual, you have to be religious to subscribe to a religion, if you will. But I think most of them that talk about spirituality seem to believe that the spirit is a bit of a separate entity and that there may be an eternal nature to it. And what does that mean? You keep going around and around in this sphere, if you will, or whether there are other dimensions, I don't know. But I definitely think of it as three components. And I think to be healthy, you need to pay attention to all three. You could be a complete atheist and still meditate because it's good for the spirit, you know, or the consciousness or the energy or whatever it is. So I think the three are critical components to high functioning, satisfying life.
And I guess you nurture all three yourself, and I didn't mean to actually put you on the spot here on this subject that it came up. Given that you've done so much work for others, you know, supporting hostages, right? Getting people out of bad places, whether it's the bad guy who you don't want to die or the hostage who you certainly don't want to die. Do you see that there's you're not sure about the afterlife, I imagine, you know, so it seems like you do a lot on this earth, you know, to care about others. How do you think about that?
Well, I'm one of those people that believe in that everybody's purpose is to have a positive impact in whatever it is that you might be your skill set. And I think everybody's capable of being absolutely world class at something. Now, they might not always discover what it is, I don't know how somebody discovers what it is, by accident, by guidance, you know, by the guidance of the universe. But I think we're all here to make a positive difference, and I think we're all capable of that. And that's in really broad terms how I think about it.
And the Black Swan Group's mission, and your mission personally, you've stated a few times, is to help others work out better relationships. Or maybe you could restate it or paraphrase what I said, you know, your mission.
Yeah, better relationships, you know, have a better life collaboratively, you know, give yourself a better life, put your family in a better house, give your kids a better education, you know, and to profit along the way. I mean, you know, I don't believe in grabbing with both hands, but I think that if you're doing a lot of good in the world, then simultaneously secondary benefit of making money off of it is just fine. If you make a lot of money, but you're not doing a lot of good, if you're a mercenary, if you're hurting people on a regular basis, it's usually pretty short-term gain. And the people that make a lot of money doing that short-term are very visible, and they tend to go down in flames eventually. Mm-hmm. And you know, you reap what you sow, to use a religious phrase. So I mean, that's just what I'm trying to do. I think everybody has the ability to get there. Now, whether or not they do, a certain amount of circumstances that make it more difficult or easier for them to find their way.
And in that, so it seems like for you, the current moment or the current 10 years or your current lifetime or your family's lifetime is, you know, where you feel like you can contribute. And you've done a lot to help people just get a better life. So that's a great fundamental principle overall, whether it's better work, whether it's better relationships, better personal life, you know, better self-actualization. And, you know, as we think about health, you see people out there, and I use your words, they're doing self-detrimental behavior. You talk about the cab driver you had in Vegas, I think it was, and it was a guy who you felt was, you know, he looked obese and he didn't look like he was taking care of himself. And your initial view when you got out of the airport and got into the cab was like, oh man, this guy's really struggling. Would you mind sharing that anecdote and how we think about self-defeating behavior and people not feeling their best, even though they might want to?
Yeah, the guy was clearly struggling, and he was sort of oozing negativity when I got into the lift. And so sometimes I react poorly to that. You know, I get triggered. I'm the type that takes things as a challenge often. It's a little bit of how I'm wired. And, you know, I'm struggling with my bags, and I got a lift driver that ain't lifting a finger to help me get in his truck, or didn't even get out and open up the rear end. Like, if I'm getting ready to get in, I mean, I think you're voluntarily in this job, and you don't have to go for a 5-star review or a tip. But if you want to be reviewed as giving 5-star service, and if you want a tip, then to get reviewed as giving 5-star service, you ought to give it, because it's a voluntary job. And, you know, this guy ain't lifting a finger to help me, and I get in and I'm tired, and I look at this poor guy, and it looks like his diet's not in order, and we pull off, and he's seething, oozing just unhappiness and resentment. And I just think, look, I don't want this to be an unpleasant journey for the two of us. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I am using a lot these days that tends to create a state change almost instantaneously with a person is I say, what do you love about what you do for a living? Because that immediately puts you in a different frame of mind. It triggers your brain into stuff that you love. So I say, what do you love about driving for Lyft? And this guy starts telling me about how he's gives him flexible hours so he can look after his grandson, because his son got out of a relationship, and his son is looking at, no, his daughter. His daughter got out of a relationship, and he's looking to take care of his grandson so his daughter can work. And this guy is struggling with a lot, and he's shouldering a lot of family problems that he didn't create, but he feels responsibility and love for his daughter. So I'm grateful that I don't get in my own way and cause us both to take a half an hour journey with one another where we're left worse off as a result of the interaction. And I did it just to kind of save myself. It was very selfish in the first place. And I ended up being much more appreciative and reminding myself to be a little less judgmental of the initial impressions I get of people. If they're angry, if they're upset, if they're seething resentment, you know, the saying goes, if you knew what they were struggling with, you'd take it a lot easier on them. Mm-hmm. And I got in the moment to find out what he was really struggling with, and we both ended up, I didn't negatively impact him, and I ended up being better off as a human being because of what the guy shared with me.
And your preconception was kind of incorrect, right? Because he was struggling so hard with, I mean, he was shouldering a lot, right? He was carrying a lot. And so it made sense that his body, his spirit, his negativity was kind of there. You understood it. It put it in
context. Yeah, I overreacted. I get triggered right off the bat. You know, mm-hmm. Jim Camp used to always talk about, he wrote a book called Start With Knowing. Jim and I collaborated and we were friends. And he always talked about the reaction. And a lot of people discuss that in different ways, but it's like trying to not go with your initial instinctive reaction and finding a way to step back a little bit and analyze a little bit more before you're pulling a trigger on if you got a short fuse, and some of us do.
And for you, it's like you have a bit of a short fuse. In this situation, folks listening might be like, well, it's triggering because you're tired. He didn't help you out. Like, in New York, I expect that behavior, you know, but in Vegas, you know, you hope that people are a little more kind. You know, cabbies in New York just don't even get out. And I know you're in New York today. And it, with this guy, I mean, what triggered you? Because I feel a similar triggering when I see someone like really oozing negativity. And I guess some people maybe can put a blocker up, but it feels like for you, somebody's aura, for lack of a better word, really affects you and it would interrupt your day. I mean, 30 minutes is, you know, 5% of your day or so. And so you wanted to actively change that, and that fits your assertive nature. So what triggered you about him?
Well, you know, you're voluntarily in a job. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot, because I'm in New York today, but I live in Vegas. And, you know, I'm always looking at profiles of human beings. And what I typically see in Vegas, you get into a lift and the person is unhappy. Now, they're in a job that is a voluntary position. This is entrepreneurial. I mean, nobody drafted you. You're choosing to be there. And frequently when I've seen people, especially in Vegas, I've noticed it even more. For whatever reason, Vegas has burned them out. And I don't know what all the circumstances are, but consistently on a regular basis, if I get their history out of them, Vegas has burned them out. Now, simultaneously, you can get into a lift in Vegas, and they're happy as clams. I mean, they are loving life. And almost without exception, they're from Southern California. And they came from a job, Southern California, they were working 24/7, 2-3 jobs, barely able to make their rent. Now they moved from Southern California to Vegas, and now they're working one job, and driving for Lyft is the only thing they're doing, instead of three jobs. And on top of that, they're not just making their rent, they bought a house. With the same amount of work and the same amount of effort, they bought a house. And they're loving life. And so you see two separate people doing exactly the same job. And one of them is miserable and the other is happy. And they're doing exactly the same job. So to me, that tells me how much of life is total interpretation. How can, you know, you're doing exactly the same thing as somebody else and you're miserable and this other person is happy. So this is how much we do to ourselves in life.
And the lesson there is, you know, one of perspective. Of course, the guy had a lot on his plate. You know, where you start to where you go and your expectations matter a lot. And I was just in Tanzania. You might have been there. You've probably been to Africa. Man, they have it rough. You know, we were in rural Tanzania. People are eating once a day, maybe. And I don't want to give the platitude that they're happy. You know what I mean? It's just, there's a different attitude towards work, towards money, towards the future, towards the next day. You know, if you don't have your basic needs met, it's tough to feel okay. And yet the future there is not as secure. I mean, I'll have some of the tribe leaders on the podcast here and some of their health leaders that I spoke with, but I talk to a lot of folks and they're kind of happy and they're kind of okay, you know, even given tough situations. You know, when you talk about health, when it's your dad or your mom or your sister or your partner, you know, oftentimes, especially in my family, you know, early, you know, I'm first generation, so they immigrated here. You know, Ukraine was rough. Soviet Union was rough. You know, you've probably dealt with those countries in your time. And they are very happy, I could say, for my family, because they came from here and they came here in poverty and now they came to here and I was raised pretty well. You know, I would say upper middle class. And then what I'm really struggling with, and the reason I brought you on, is how do we get these folks in my family and folks like them to take care of themselves and not just coast and say, well, I got here, that's enough. My expectations are smashed out of the park with a home run. How do you get them to get back up to bat again?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, the application of understanding, which is the application of empathy, you know, tactical empathy, just demonstrating you understand. Now, that gives, in any communication, in any interaction that you have where you want somebody to consider a different course of action, a tactical empathy and empathy is your best chance of success, always. And the caveat with that statement, which I learned when I was a hostage negotiator, when I was in a case that somebody got killed first time, I remember saying to myself, well, and I learned that phrase from Gary Nestner, my former boss. He used to always say, best chance of success. That means that it's not always going to work. best chance of success, by definition, means sometimes you're not going to have the influence. Sometimes they're not going to change their behavior. Sometimes things are going to go bad. And a point of fact, in hostage negotiation, our success rate was about 93%, 93, 94%, which meant that once you started climbing past double digits, you know, just based on the odds, you had to accept the fact that something was going to go bad, no matter if you did everything you could have done. If based on everything you knew at the time, mm-hmm. you made all the right decisions. And most of the time, that's the case. I mean, people get torn apart in hindsight, and somebody wants to judge them on information that they didn't have at the time. Yeah, well, you know, if we knew that, but we didn't know that. Well, you should have known that. Well, no, we shouldn't have. You know, as a human being, you make the best decisions based on the information you have in a moment. And judgmental 2020 hindsight, by the way, hindsight is not 2020. That's nonsense. But your best chance of success. So, and I know I'm going on for a long time, but you get back to your family and your friends. You know, help them demonstrate that you understand, show them that you understand, and then the rest of it is up to them. The best you could do is just demonstrate an understanding of where they're coming from.
And what if I disagreed with you, and if I can use some of your techniques and kind of summarize and say, like, well, what if there were times where I was able to intervene? It's like my grandma had a stroke. She really didn't want to get out of the bed. I laid down with her in the hospital bed. I was pleading with her to, you know, come on, you can walk, you can do this. I scheduled her PT. I scheduled her the Uber. Then she got excited about it, and she actually was able to throw away the cane after having the cane. You know, for a 75-year-old, it's a big deal. So in that case, and you're not disagreeing with that, you know, I guess one thing everyone tells me, let go of your family or your friends. And I talk to a lot of folks who have sick parents, or their parents are getting older and they want to do something. Their dad's watching too much Fox News or MSNBC. He needs some mental health care. The mom's eating too much. She's diabetic, whatever it is. And they say, well, some people tell me, well, just let it go. Understand that your role is not to save them. And other people are like, well, maybe you can just at the margins make small adjustments. So what you're saying, if I can summarize, is that first understand where they are with tactical empathy, open-ended questions, labeling what they say so it sounds like you are doing this instead of you are doing this, and then drawing them out a bit. Once you've got the understanding container built, then where do you go from there when it comes to your family or your friends, someone close to you?
Well, see, I don't see anything wrong with what you did. I mean, I think in your actions and in your demeanor, I mean, you were from your description, I mean, like, you're oozing with love and caring for somebody. And depending upon who somebody is, where they are in your life, I mean, there's also a special relationship between grandparents and grandchildren. I mean, it's sort of almost a cliche in every society. You know, the old joke goes, why do grandparents and grandchildren get along so well? They got a common enemy. So, you know, and my son Brandon and my mother were insanely close. Like, my mother and my son, her grandson, you know, she had conversations with him she didn't have with anybody else ever. Not her sister, not her husband, not her other children, not her mother. I mean, you know, there's something really interesting about the bond between grandparents and grandchildren that I think is special to begin with. Now, so, and that's that was part of your story. Some of it is, I think, because of the difference in age, we have a tendency to wound people inadvertently through the course of our lives. So the chances that I'm going to have said and done stupid stuff when I was younger that wounded my sisters, or that my parents, when I was little, had done things to try to put me in the right track that it inadvertently wounded me. For a variety of reasons, there's less wounding, inadvertent wounding, that goes back and forth between grandparents and grandchildren. You know, a parent is still struggling to be a human being, you know, and how they treat their children. Whereas, you know, the grandparents got a 20, 30-year head start on that. They're making fewer mistakes with their grandchildren. They're also more tolerant for a variety of reasons. You know, you see movies all the time where grandfather's taking his grandson out to get him laid, where he would have done that with his son. So, yeah, you know, there is a very different relationship between grandparents and grandchildren.
And how do you think with parents and children, you know, especially, was your mom, if you don't mind me asking, she's still with us or?
No, my mom died about two and a half years ago.
Sorry to hear. And yeah, that's life, right? I mean, that's life and
it
death.
Is,
and,
yeah.
Did you need to counsel her on her health as she was getting older? Did you have to take some responsibility, or how did that play out in your family?
We never really got to the point, you know, she had more longevity demonstrated in her family than she ended up, you know, her mother lived about 15 years longer than she ended up living. So, you know, there was a bit of an assumption on our part that she was going to last. And when I last saw her, I was into saunas at the time. I still am. I got a sauna in my backyard. You know, I listened to Rhonda Patrick give a talk 4 or 5 years ago where she said, you know, 30 minutes of sauna 4 to 7 times a week, and it was finished dry sauna, where the stat was, she said, 40% drop in all-cause mortality. Like, that's a staggering number.
Unbelievable. I mean, if you could
achieve that. 40% all cause.
Yeah, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's,
pick it,
all of it.
Everything. So, yeah, so I buy my mother a sauna, and I put it in the basement of her house. And I can't get her to sit in it. Like, the only time I could get her to sit in it was when I was there. And she wouldn't, you know, my mother's was a very practical person. My son and I were just laughing about this the other day. You know, I'm sure my mom thought, you know, we're teasing, that she said, it's hot in Iowa anyway. It's hot in the summertime. Why do I got to spend my electrical bill to go sit in a sauna? I go sit outside if I want to be hot. Heck, in the summertime, I'm paying for air conditioning. You know, we were just joking. It was probably my mother's
attitude. That's her accent. Yeah. And then, so what'd you try to use to convince her? And it didn't work, I guess, right? Because she never ended up using it? Or is there a big jump?
Nah, she wouldn't use it. Now, simultaneously, when she was at her home in Iowa, I mean, she's going to an aerobics class twice a week. Yeah. And she's doing other stuff, you know. But I did what I could to have a positive impact on her health. And simultaneously, I want her to be happy. So if and I wasn't presented with the same opportunity scenario where she's stroking on a handicapped bed, you know, an impaired bed, where it's, if you get up, you can kind of get back into it. You know, I didn't have those circumstances. When she ended up dying, it was completely out of my control, and I didn't find out what the circumstances were till she was in hospice. And that, you know, I had to accept that that was the universe's will, that was God's will. I mean, there's some things you can change and some things you can't. Sort of understanding which ones are which is the challenge of being a human being. And, you know, that one was out of my hands.
And so the sauna, you tried to, you know, give her that, no matter all your negotiation techniques, or your son Brandon, I've read a few of his articles on getting closer with your family, you know, she wasn't going for it. And maybe you didn't push too hard, but she probably wasn't a bad negotiator herself, you know. And so you tried, and she let you put it in the basement, which was probably a win.
And
I'd love to touch on, you know, a little bit more on your family and also your own personal health techniques, because you travel so much and you're high powered and you meet a lot of, I won't say high-powered, high-performing. You know, you do a lot. You strike me as someone with a lot of energy. So I want to get to that. And also, you know, with your dad, was it a similar situation? Did it play out differently? And anyone else in your life that you've had the chance to impact them with your health negotiation techniques?
Well, my father ended up, when he died back in 98, I mean, he went pretty quickly. He was in, other than the cancer that got into his system that had reached a level where it was in his lymphatic system, which is, by the time they discovered that it was there, which is, you're kind of done at that point in time. He was a very healthy guy. I mean, young-looking guy, vibrant, hard-working, worked really hard and very vibrant. So, and he'd become conscious of his diet based on what was known about diet at the time. His father had died due to cholesterol blockage in the arteries. Back then, they called it hardening of the arteries, if you will. And his father, I never knew the man. He died, I think, I don't know if it was before I was born or shortly after. But because of that, my father had gotten very conscious of his diet and had been very careful with it for easily 20 years when he died, based on what was known about diet at the time. And cancer detection back then was far less accurate than it is now, and he'd felt badly, like a flu that he couldn't shake, and had been in and out of the doctor's office a number of times, and they just couldn't nail it down. And then ultimately, in fighting a cancer, he had a heart attack, and they rushed him to the hospital, and you know, they did the, you know, with the electric restart of the heart, I don't recall what that terminology is, and that was when they discovered that he had cancer throughout his system. And he didn't go easy. He refused to go easy, and he fought it off pretty well, I think principally based on his attitude, for about three more months, and then that was it.
And you were, that was 98, so you were in the midst of your FBI career, and it was a surprise too, because he was a healthy guy, because his dad had died young. And so,
yeah.
And so does that impact your view of health? Like, because your dad did his best, right? And he still got cancer. Your grandpa, I don't know, you know, his health situation, but he died young. So does that make you really conscious of your health?
Pretty conscious. I mean, I'm relatively speaking, I'm pretty disciplined. I started at about that time being very conscious of cancer, reducing supplements. And okay. I have been.
Supplements. Oh, yeah, cancer, well,
antioxidants.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the stuff that would fight you. I mean, and by and large, I never really smoked. I've avoided in my life most of the things that have been linked strongly to cancer, that, you know, that doesn't make you immune from it. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed being in pretty good shape. When I was younger, I lifted weights a lot more than I do now. I still do, you know, aerobics when I can. So I like being healthy for a lot of other reasons, and longevity is kind of a fringe benefit of that.
So for you, what are you doing around, like, food when you travel, you know, when you're on airplanes and stuff, exercise when you travel, sleep? Give me the quick ones, then we'll probably get into negotiation stuff.
Yeah, all that's brutal. I mean, sleep is easily the most of three very important components. Sleep might be the most important, and with the time changes, I mean, that's brutal. That's really hard. And you know, I got a combination of both. I keep melatonin and Ambien with me. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm listening to Andrew Huberman talking about viewing sunlight at certain parts of the day. Yeah. Like, I'm going for every hack that I can possibly get to try to square away my sleep as much as possible. And in diet, I'm much poorer on the road. I'm limiting my carbs. I'm trying to increase my water and protein intake. And, you know, I also don't want to sacrifice enjoyment for longevity. You know, you can live a really long time and live a boring life that you're just not happy with. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little more interested in enjoyment and vitality. And when I'm on the road, especially, I my diet tends to sacrifice a little bit in that direction. Wendy and I went to a French restaurant last night and thoroughly enjoyed the meal. And I ate a couple of things that my longevity doctor would have wished that I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I was out with her and I was enjoying the evening and enjoying being in New York City.
To enjoy the moment. And so food is where you might fall down a bit, but you're conscious of it, you're aware of it. Sleep, I know you're big on Huberman. You were mentioning him a few times on a couple of the podcasts I listened to, and he's got a lot on jet lag and light timing and caffeine timing and all that, which I'm sure you're implementing. And cardio wise you're doing some cardio, so that gives you the energy to fly around the world and give talks and coach people.
And you know, and I enjoy it. That gives me energy. I mean, it's mentally, mm-hmm. how do you interpret it? And then, it's hard to find a decent sauna on the road, but I got one at home, and then also, again, you know, I'll probably mention my girlfriend Wendy 30 times in this. She got me a cold plunge, and I got a cold plunge in my backyard. God. And
Do you negotiate yourself into that? I mean, that's brutal, man.
It's a fascinating challenge of how you rewire physical stimulus. And again, Huberman, I heard him say on one podcast that pain is an emotional reaction, an emotional interpretation to a physical stimulus. And I'm like, what? I'm like, you know, either it hurts or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And hitting a cold plunge, uh-huh. like at about the same time, you know, I used to think that it was painful to get into it. And I happened to have crushed a little toe in a door jamb. And it was swollen badly. And getting in the cold plunge always relieved and accelerated the healing of that. And I went from I hate the cold to feeling immediate relief and pleasure and healing. Getting in the exact same water and the exact same temperature. So it was all in how my brain was interpreting it.
And I know you're big on that. You know, you've worked with the folks who are behavioral psychologists. You cite Kahneman a lot. And so for you, the cold plunge actually relieved pain. So you got a kind of a nice, you know, reframe there. Is there anything that you negotiate with your health or your performance, your energy that you don't like to do, but you still do?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you something. I'm hitting a cold plunge first thing in the morning, and there's some mornings when I get up, I do not feel like getting in that baby.
Huh. How do you square that with yourself?
Yeah. Well, then it's, you know, vision drives decision. Vision what? Vision of the future. Vision of what's going to happen in the future. I can talk myself into doing something or not doing something by thinking about what the outcome's going to be. Like, I'm happy to get into a cold plunge when I think about the fact that, you know, when I get out, I'm going to feel charged up. And mm-hmm. So the vision of the future, I can think about what it's going to feel like to get in it. And now I'm going, oh, God, this is going to stink. Or I can take my brain and think about what it's going to feel like after I get out. And then I'm looking forward to it. You know, on a given food, if, you know, something carb heavy, you know, something mm-hmm. laced with icing, you know, some big, great big giant donut from someplace, mm-hmm. you know, you can think about how good that's going to taste, and then it's hard to resist. Or if then I think about the sugar crash that's going to come a half an hour later, and how lethargic and just almost depressed I'm going to feel. I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to have anything to do with that. So it's what moment in the future your brain is envisioning that really controls what you do, making the decision of the present.
And so when it comes to like someone's health, if you were counseling someone on their health, or if I'm doing it as a health coach or a doctor, I mean, you have a doctor who says, hey, it's not good for you to eat that ice cream sundae every week. And the person goes, I know, but it kind of gives me some comfort after work. And doctor says, well, hey, you're overweight, your risk of heart disease is 30% higher than the average, your 10-year mortality is, you know, 3%, whereas someone who isn't overweight, exercises daily, sleeps enough, has a 10-year mortality, all-cause mortality of 0.5%. And so what you're saying, I think, is to have the person envision the pain. But if they don't even know what a sugar crash is, like, they don't really feel it because they're not so interoceptive, they're not so in touch with their body, you know, how would you counsel somebody to paint this future for them? Because to me, the death thing is too far away. Maybe you have a skill where you can cue yourself and say, I don't want that all-cause mortality in 40 years, so I'm going to buy a sauna and religiously do it. But for someone who's maybe not in that vein, how do you counsel them to get the short-term into the medium-term or short-term into the long-term? Something I'm really struggling with.
Well, people that are doing that, you know, focus a little bit on what are they feeling right now. I mean, somebody's having trouble seeing a brighter future. What do they feel? They feel defeated. They feel like they can't make a difference in life. They feel like no matter what they do, the world is just not going to give them a chance. Simply calling that out is how you start to turn the tide. You know, you're not trying to convince them. You're not trying to say, I don't want you to feel defeated. You know, the application of empathy is, sounds like you kind of feel defeated. Sounds like, and no matter what you do, it's never going to make a difference. It's one of the few things in the Black Swan Method. We know it all works. We haven't got the neuroscience to back it up yet. And this is one that is solidly backed up by neuroscience. Because they've run studies when people are thinking negative thoughts, if the negativity is simply called out, then the fMRI shows that the electrical activity in a region of the brain where negativity is housed reduces. Like, simply calling out the elephant in the room is the most effective way to get it to go away. Not denying it, not telling somebody the elephant shouldn't be there, not telling them they can tackle the elephant if they just get themselves together. It's saying, like, you know, there's an elephant in the room. Just calling it out. And a number of studies have been done that is the most consistent and effective way to get rid of negativity. Just simply call it out. The application of empathy is calling out, demonstrating, articulating what the other side is feeling, it, not denying it, and not following it with, but if you just did this, and it's also, I feel that too. You know, this, and there's an extended application of that I hate, the feel, felt, found. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt the way you did once. I know how you feel. I felt that too. Here's what I found is the answer, that feel, felt, found. That is horrible. And
why?
It does not work.
Because it.
Well, in point of fact.
Tell me why. Yeah.
You don't really care. It doesn't help you to know that you felt that way. Now, I can understand how we got off track of this because, you know, there's a lot of psychological data out there. Brené Brown, I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, since she was talking about shame. I had the privilege of listening to her in a private talk recently. And she said that shame cannot exist in isolation. So there's a lot that we feel better about if we don't feel alone, if we don't feel in isolation. Now, so a lot of well-intended but wrong-headed reaction to that guidance is say to somebody, I feel the same as you. Good idea, good intention, and in point of time, in point of application, they don't care. It doesn't help them. And when I was on a suicide hotline, you know, they used to describe it, when you're trying to help somebody, somebody who's in quicksand, it doesn't help them to get in the quicksand with them. And somehow we've interpreted this to say, look, if we just get in the quicksand with them, they're going to feel good too. They'll feel better. And in practical application, that's why suicide hotlines, crisis hotlines, teach you to not do that. Do not get in a quicksand with them. And that's what I learned way back when. So I get the proper training on how to react. Like, you don't care that I know how you feel, that I felt the way you felt. It does make a difference if I can show that I know how you feel. And I can take somebody, you can be going through an experience I have never gone through, ever. And I can say, yeah, you feel defeated. You feel abandoned. You feel alone. You feel like whatever you do, it's just going to be useless. I never said I felt any of that. Mm-hmm. But you're going to feel better because I called it out and recognized it.
And when it comes to shame, it's such a deep-seated thing that if you can call it out, recognize it with delicacy using some of the techniques that you teach, then that might almost erase it in the brain, and then somebody, not erase it, but it unearths it, and then somebody can move forward. But if it's not unearthed, they're doing that checklist, which you touch on quite often in your work, where they're thinking, well, I've got this, I failed at this in the past, you know, I tried this 10 years ago to lose weight, my mom said I could never lose weight. So if you can do some informational interviewing and open-ended questions and draw them out with labeling, mirroring, summarizing, paraphrasing, you help them, you know, vocalize all that negativity, and then once the negativity is out there, they feel comfortable with you because you know their story. But if the kind of healthy person or the person counseling them, whether it be doctor or coach, doesn't really get into the weeds of what brought them there, then the person doesn't really trust them and doesn't feel heard and will just default to their old story, because the old story makes comfort.
There's a certain amount of, you hit on a lot of really interesting things there, and there's a certain amount of comfort there. And it becomes known. One of a number of things that are bad but are true. The devil known is better than a devil unknown. You know, if somebody, no matter how bad it is now, if somebody's still surviving day to day, they say to themselves, look, at least I'm surviving. You know, it could get worse. And they're horrified at the unknown or the possibility of it getting worse. And that's what really stops a lot of people from taking action to make the small changes that will eventually, you know, help them to climb out. But it's human nature. The devil known is easier to cope with than the devil unknown. And that's why many people are horrified at making steps to make changes, because they're saying, like, well, you know, no matter how bad it is, I still got up this morning.
Can you talk about diffusing the ego when you're talking to somebody like that? And and how they can let go of what was and just step into a newer place, and how to project the future 30 days, 60 days, 90 days out. Because you do it in negotiations too. You say, well, if this goes really well, you know, like that lawyer guy you mentioned, if this goes really well in a year, 10 years from now, where are we going to be?
You know, I'm not sure, because you get into a certain amount of terminology, you know, there's some premises there. I wouldn't say that I'm really looking to diffuse anybody's ego. What I'm trying to be in many cases is a better sounding board and help them either recognize something that's driving them or uncover something that's driving them that they're no longer aware of. And then ultimately, I may be trying to get them to build their ego, and because people need to feel autonomy, they need to feel an agency, which means the decision's got to be theirs. Mm-hmm. And the more I make it clear to them, look, it's on you. I mean, I'm just trying to talk to you about the reality of what's ahead. And, you know, we could talk about how life's going to be if you take these positive steps. You can also talk about, you know, how life's going to continue to deteriorate if you don't. Like, you know, a great question is, what happens if you do nothing? Mm-hmm. I mean, on your current course, what happens if you do nothing? I mean, that's just making someone look at the consequences without them feeling like you made them do it. A critical issue is always doing as much as you can to preserve their autonomy, because they'll die to preserve their autonomy. And you got to preserve their autonomy.
You hit the nail on the head. Ego, in this case, I define it like autonomy. Yeah, exactly. You got to preserve it. And by not telling people what to do, but by active listening, by tactical empathy, you're walking them maybe down a path with you together.
Ideally, yeah. You want to act as a guide. You're guiding as much as you can.
And, you know, there's different situations, whether it's your parent or your kid or your partner. Could you just touch on one thing as we're finishing up, is like the role that you play? Because when you're a kid, you know, you're not supposed to take care of your parent. They take care of you. When you get older, those roles might start to switch, but how do you put that hat on? How do you talk about roles generally, like when in sensitive conversations?
Wow. Yeah, I think my principal role is empathy is, you know, me just showing you that I understand and trying to dig into helping you see what's driving you a little bit more. And then ultimately, I think everybody's role is to be as supportive and as collaborative as possible, you know, to live up to your word and to, you know, eliminate injury as much as, inadvertent injury as much as you possibly can. And then that kind of role is that, you know, as you grow older, maybe you're looking after your parents. I mean, they're always going to be your parents. They're not going to want to feel like they're your child. Mm-hmm. And so continue to respect how they see things and being supportive as possible. And then, you know, what can you change, and what do you got to let go are always the hard questions.
And you found some peace with that. No matter how kind of assertive you are and how you like to control your reality, you've also, when your mom didn't want the sauna, and that, you know, that's just one example, you didn't call her every day like, hey, get in the sauna. When you were there, you tried it. She made her argument that it's already hot in Iowa, and you were able to have your peace and say it's kind of not my job. So, it's something about having your peace, but encouraging autonomy and encouraging thought and being a companion to someone.
I would think so. I think that's well said.
And where did you catch Brené Brown? Was that on Fireside, or where was that?
So I got invited back to speak at a gathering of hostage negotiators with the FBI. Crisis Negotiation Unit, where I used to work, they had every 2 years they bring all the hostage negotiation coordinators from around the country in, and these are the best people. These are the people that are running and operating a program, you know, in Dallas and Houston and Pittsburgh and Kansas City. Senior people. It's a great conference. And I was privileged enough that they asked me to come back and talk. And I'm like, I am flattered that you guys are bringing me back. And they had taken a chance and offered Brené Brown an invitation to talk. I didn't even know she was going to be there. I didn't even know she was in the back of the room. And I go through my segment, and then they introduce the next speaker, and we pass each other in the little aisleway between the chairs. And she says, that was great. I'm a big fan. And I'm like, holy cow, you know, I didn't even know you were in a room and you're here, you're a superstar. And then she sat down in front of the group and just started laying these pearls of wisdom on everybody about, you know, one of the things that really jumped out at me is like self-knowledge is required before self-actualization. I mean, if you want to self-actualize, which is a term that you used earlier, you kind of got to come to grips with yourself first to move forward. I mean, she just laid one thing after another on us that I'm furiously taking notes. I think I took more notes than anybody in the room. Mm-hmm. And so that was where I was lucky enough to run across her.
Wow. And you were familiar with her before that, and she got you to that self-knowledge one, which is a really good place to end here, because I want to thank you for your time and be respectful. I know the newsletter comes out every Tuesday morning still, and yep. Folks can sign up for that on blackswanltd.com.
Yep.
Just moved mine into my primary inbox, so I'm making sure I get it. There's the masterclass that you're featured on, and folks can sign up. How much is that? Because that's quite affordable for folks.
A masterclass is a ridiculous value. It's, I think, last I checked, the subscription for a year to all of their content was $180, something to that effect. I mean, they deliver some of the highest quality content, and you can't get our course by itself for that anywhere else, let alone access to everything they have for a year. So the masterclass is a phenomenal deal, and their production values are through the roof.
And let's see, Fireside is now a group coaching option, which I think makes sense, because otherwise people got to fly out for a seminar. They got to have calls with you or with Brandon or Sandy or with the team, Derek.
Right.
Can you tell us about Fireside?
Yeah, it's kind of the next step. If you've done the book and you've done masterclass, which are phenomenally complementary cornerstones, okay, then where do you go next? And Fireside is an app on your phone. It's a subscription service. And it was originally pitched to us as an interactive podcast, live interactive podcast. And what we found out is, in point of fact, it's group coaching. And so if you were to buy group coaching from us, it's $5,000 an hour for a group, $5,000 for an hour. And we do it weekly, so it means that there's 4 to 5 hours a month on Fireside. And instead of paying $5,000 an hour, you're paying $1,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Weekly
coaching, right? Yeah, you get, you know, it's a weekly 1 hour group coaching,
and
we got people signing in from all over the world.
Yep, so they can actually get real answers to their situations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, because sometimes they're going through work, they want to raise, they're negotiating a deal that might be $1 million, so 10% on $1 million is $100K, and they're only spending $1,000 on yours, so I would do it too. And then there's Black Swan's seminars and coaching, which can be found on the site too. Chris Voss, you've been a hero to me. I'm going to tell that story at the intro as people will hear. So Chris Voss, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This is really cool. I think people haven't heard that side of you and can have some takeaways for themselves and their families. Thanks again for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to my first ever Green Pill podcast with Chris Voss. No doubt you learned something, changed your perspective, or took away a new tool or template to make yourself and your loved ones healthier and happier. The best way to support me is by subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple, preferably all three. And if it feels right, leave up to a 5-star review. Thanks for taking the Green Pill, and I'll see you next week.